Welcome to Ariel Investments Conversation Series for Black History Month. I'm Arielle Patrick, Chief Communications Officer of Ariel. As the first Black-owned investment firm in the United States, we have seen overwhelming evidence that diverse leadership, workforces, and supply chains drive better outcomes for all stakeholders. It also drives better outcomes for shareholders like us. It's no secret that the past 2 years have challenged us as a society. The Black Lives Matter movement reignited a centuries-old dialogue around racial inequality and highlighted the need for urgent action. The COVID-19 pandemic continues to remind us of the fragility of balance sheets and the vulnerability of our communities, especially those of people of color. However, many of today's societal challenges are economic. Now more than ever, the private sector can take a leading role in addressing social issues. 21st century corporate management teams must think holistically about designing their operating environments around diversity, equity, and inclusion to drive change across the globe. To be successful, however, they must also measure it. What gets measured gets done. So how do we measure success? At Ariel, it's with what we call the three P's: people, purchasing, and philanthropy. Each week, we will focus on one of these themes to bring calls to action for diversity, equity, and inclusion to corporations and shareholders alike. These insights will be delivered by legends in these industries. This week, we will talk about philanthropy with the Knight Foundation's CFO and Treasurer, Juan Martinez, Columbia University's Endowment CEO, Kim Liu, and Ariel's own founder, John Rogers. Thank you so much, John, Juan, and Kim, for joining us for this special conversation series hosted by Ariel for Black History Month. I just want to start with a little icebreaker and ask everyone to introduce themselves, a quick overview of their day job, and a figure in Black history, particularly Black American history, that has been most influential to them. So I'm going to start with Kim.
Hi, I'm Kim Liu. I'm the CEO and president of the Columbia Investment Management Company, and I am charged with managing the endowment for Columbia University. The bulk of my day is spent managing the team and building relationships with the constituents that are important to the university. To answer your question about the figure that it's most influential to, for me, it's a challenge because there's so many for various reasons. And I always have to start with one, obviously not as famous. My grandmother is the most influential Black figure in my life for so many reasons, including the fact that she kept me humble and reminded me of sort of what were priorities and how I should make sure that I stay sort of grounded in our community. When I think about figures that most people know well, there's something that always resonated with me about Sojourner Truth and sort of where she started and where she ended and how she was an advocate for Black people and slaves in particular and enslaved people. And I, you know, that's always been an important figure, but there's so many, it's hard to narrow it down to one.
Thanks. I'm Juan Martinez. I'm the CFO and treasurer of the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. In that capacity, I'm responsible for the day-to-day financial operations of the organization, and that includes all of the nuts and bolts of paying people, paying stuff, making sure that we're compliant with IRS regulations. And then as part of the executive committee of the foundation, I'm part of the developing and implementing our strategy in our programs and in our operations. To me, it's funny that Kim was mentioning the sort of variety of people who influence you, because I think that's always true, right? That there's a constellation of people who each helped to guide us. I mean, I'm a Christian, and so for me, that is the worldview that guides my worldview. That's the lens through which I see the world, and I hope that guides my actions. So for me, a key influential figure, especially in Black American culture, is Dr. Martin Luther King, not just for the way he acted in his, in the public stances that he took and his speeches and things of that nature, but his call to personal responsibility to others, and your personal actions and how you guide your life in the context of others. And to me, that's rooted in a central belief of the sort of God-given divinity of each individual, you know, so.
I love that. John Rogers.
Hi, I'm John Rogers, the founder and co-CEO of Ariel Investments. I spend my day primarily focused on overseeing our small and mid-cap value strategy here in Chicago. I've been focusing and fishing in the same fishing pond for the last 39 years. And I just love reading about stocks, thinking about the stock market, talking to management teams. And that's what I do day to day. But it's a lot of reading from morning to night, trying to make sure I'm totally on top of what's happening within our portfolios. When it comes to African-American leaders, you know, I have to say my parents, of course. I was lucky. I had two pioneering parents. My mom was the first African-American woman to graduate from the University of Chicago Law School in 1946, where she met my dad, who was returning from World War II as a Tuskegee Airman. And they met at the law school. And so both parents had an enormous amount of influence on me. But I also say, here in Chicago, we had this extraordinary group of African-American entrepreneurs. You know, we were always thought of as the Mecca when it came to Black business. And John Johnson, who had built up Ebony and Jet Magazine, was in the Johnson Publishing building. That was someone who was truly an inspiration as a young entrepreneur, as well as George Johnson, who created Johnson Products, the first African-American company to be listed on a major stock exchange. Having those two pioneers here in my hometown that I had a chance to get to know had an enormous impact and really made me understand that not only could you work hard to build a business, but also be engaged in your community, trying to give back and make a difference.
Thank you all. So let's just dig right in. One of the core things that all of you are committed to is helping foundations and endowments increase their impact and also maintain their impact. And a big part of that is ensuring that their assets are allocated to managers that perform well. But of course, Juan, your institution, the Knight Foundation, has this incredible survey that it puts out every year. We just got the results for 2021, and it's showing us that almost 99% of assets across all asset classes, right? So public equities, private equity, alternatives like hedge funds, real estate, all are managed by non-diverse owned entities. What is the barrier to entry here, and how do we really get to the crux of the issue? It can't just be performance, it's more than that. Maybe let's start with Kim Liu, who of course is a leader and a trailblazer, you know, one of very, very few Black CIOs on the street. Would love to hear why you're lonely at the top and what's going on here.
You know, I think that the world evolves over time, and it matters how you start and how you develop your practice. And I think that there are a lot of people who made choices about what fields to get into during my generation of people coming out of college and business schools. And a lot of people made an option of going into investment banking as opposed to into investing. And so, you know, that those decisions build over time. But I also think that oftentimes other people were given the opportunity and encouraged to make career shifts when opportunities changed. And there's something about the dynamic and the way that hiring and promotions and growth has happened historically in these industries that made it very challenging for people to do that in underrepresented communities in ways that it wasn't a challenge for some of our peers and counterparts in other groups. And so I think that, you know, few of us started in investing by luck. I started very early in investing, but more importantly, so few of us were allowed to make the shift into investing. And I think that's one of the challenges, and we have to start to break down those barriers.
That's really interesting. So Juan, of course, you are one of very few Latinx, you know, in-house managers, but I'm still trying to get to the crux of, so there's a barrier to entry even within the investment profession, right? Whether you're in-house or an owner of your own asset management firm. In your research, what is the issue with then jumping to diverse owned businesses? Is it that there's not enough capital or customers to scale these businesses to become asset managers for large foundations and endowments? Is there another reason? Tell us more about what's keeping these institutions from giving these mandates across any asset class to Black, Latinx, or other underrepresented minority-owned businesses.
Yeah, I'll speak not from a sort of authoritative I know the answers, but rather from sort of personal experience and some of the conversations, and then also from what we see in the data. And I think one of the things, and I kind of bucket this into the administrative argument, and the administrative argument from an asset allocator's perspective, or one of the administrative arguments, is a question of size and efficiency of allocation, right? So the idea that in order for me to allocate efficiently and to manage efficiently my business, I need to allocate a specific size, a certain minimum size of investment, and I need to also allocate the bandwidth and time of my analysts over a sort of discrete universe. That's the most efficient way to run the business. And if that's the context, then what are the lenses that you're using to make that, to sort of narrow that universe? It's typically size. And then size of assets under management, and then what are the folks in the network that you already have? What's the feedback that you're getting with regards to the potentiality of that investment from a return perspective and operational perspective? And so both of those are self-perpetuating, and they perpetuate incumbency. Incumbency becomes the larger issue. I think the counter argument to that is, one of the things that asset allocators always are looking for is this idea of lack of correlation and unique, like a differentiation of strategies. And to the extent that we look for differentiation of strategies within already established rubrics and networks, the feedback loop is strong, right? And so I think the fact that we as asset allocators, part of it is we as asset allocators have those structural biases in our mind. I think of it from an operational standpoint, right? We have structural biases in our mind as to there has to be a certain minimum size investment at the very beginning of a relationship in order for me to grow, to be as part of that. I think that's a huge issue, because then you take new firms off the table from the beginning. And also, you then create this sort of tiered system where you might say, I'm going to allocate a piece of my assets to small firms or to new firms. But then to make the jump to the next one, it's not a gradual increase. It's a binary increase. And again, that then poses a restriction to firms that are traditionally smaller, which is what we see in the data, that diverse-owned firms, while they exist and perform at the same at statistically the same level, end up being much smaller on a fund or firm size.
Can I put an exclamation point on something that Juan just said? Because the other thing that's really important is that foundations and endowments tend to have small staffs because they want to control the cost of managing at a not-for-profit. And so much of the things that we invest in are referrals, because there's so many funds out there that you're trying to find ways to narrow the funnel. So if you are being referred from other foundations and endowments that don't have networks in diverse spaces for a variety of reasons, because they haven't had incentive to look for them, and on top of that, they don't have diversities on their teams that have built networks out there, that is also self-fulfilling. So I think it's the absolutely agree with Juan said about size. I think that's a huge issue. And I also think that that's sort of the insular nature of how we refer deals to each other also exacerbates the problem.
So that's fascinating. It sounds like it's a confluence of issues, but one of the potential solutions is to lower the threshold so that we can give opportunities to more emerging managers. But speaking of which, John, you are not an emerging manager. You're almost four decades in the business, one of the longest track records in your asset class, no matter what category we're talking about, diverse or non-diverse. Why is there only one John Rogers? Thinking back to what Kim mentioned, it seems like there's a skills gap. How do we make asset management a more desirable and accessible career path? How do we address that pipeline issue? And who is the onus on? What institutions have to take action?
Thank you. I would say there's more than just me out there. As you know, Eddie Brown started his firm 6 months after we did, roughly, and he's had an extraordinary record as a growth manager. And it's kind of interesting. We're valuing Eddie's growth. And I mean, yeah, and we've been able to be friends and colleagues and competitors for almost, like I said, almost 40 years. You know, I think there's a couple of things we've tried to do at Ariel when it comes to addressing the pipeline. And part of it is to, you know, really replicate the vision that my dad had for me, where every birthday and every Christmas after I was 12 years old, he gave me shares of stock instead of toys. And, you know, that wasn't fun at first to go to the Christmas tree and get an envelope instead of a toy. But over time, he made the really great decision to let me keep the dividend checks. And he insisted that every weekend when I came to visit, I would read the quarterly reports and the annual reports on the companies he was investing in. And he made sure that I got to meet his stockbroker, who was the first African-American on LaSalle Street here in Chicago, who was working for a major brokerage firm. And having both getting the exposure to the markets, getting to read about the markets, and then having a role model who looked like me, who was in the business, really got me started. So what we've tried to do at Ariel is to try to replicate that experience for as many people as possible. So as you know, over 25 years ago, we created the Ariel Community Academy, a small public school here in Chicago, where we give the kids real money to invest in real stocks. And over 8 years, they get to see the magic of compound interest, to see how the money can grow over time. And they not only, you know, get to come in and meet with our analysts and learn about how to do the research on individual companies, they also get to see, again, people that look like them managing stock portfolios. So you're really accomplishing both goals, teaching young people about how to invest in the stock market, but also how to think about financial services careers. And we hope that we could be a role model for the way that other financial services companies could partner with urban public schools. You know, we shouldn't be the only one doing that here in Chicago. There should be more that are doing that and creating the kind of climate that we've had. And then finally, as you know, we created a program at the University of Chicago for minority students to get paid internships to work in the endowment offices of major endowments throughout the nation. And we've had over 100 students go through the program. We're growing the program. It's been really, really well received. Foundations love having these young, diverse, talented people work for them. And the young people often didn't know anything about endowment management, didn't know about all the different asset classes that they could invest in. It's been something that's been really exciting for the young people to get that exposure. So we hope that also could be a model for the way money managers can partner with their local universities and give kids that kind of experience that we're trying to do with the University of Chicago.
That's fabulous. Kim and Juan, either of you can answer this. Let's talk about John Lewis's iconic quote, making good trouble. What's keeping in-house CIOs from putting pressure on asset managers to either cultivate diverse talent or put them on their mandate or really fulfill what I think we've talked about in private conversations, governments have been able to do, you know, with municipal bonds, et cetera, with larger sort of bulge bracket banks. What is the hindrance here and why is it hard to do that?
Kim, I can take a stab at that. Is that okay? Well, I just think part of it is I think there's bandwidth and hierarchy of all of the different requirements that you see as important and what you prioritize? I think every busy executive has that that they are dealing with. But I will just say, I think you need to take, there is a certain amount of personal responsibility that you just need to say, I'm going to prioritize a good action today. Just a good action. I'm going to make sure that this happens. And I'm going to do something good because I think it's something good. And by the way, I also think that it's an excellent way to build capacity in my organization. I think it's an excellent way to get talent. I think it's an excellent way to add diversity of perspective within my investment function. I mean, there's a lot of ancillary knock-on effects to it that how you look at it really matters. Too often, I think investment people are great risk managers. That's the, like, we love to talk about how we think about opportunity and maximizing opportunity and finding unique opportunities, but the other element of it, the other hat we wear, is we mitigate risk. We try to mitigate risk. If you are viewing diverse managers as an asset class, for example, right? There's an inherent risk associated with a diverse asset class, as opposed to saying, I have a manager, I have a new manager, this is my diverse investment associate, or this is my investment associate. There's a, you know, if you're thinking about it as a separate activity from the core element of who you are and what you're doing, then I think one way that it could materialize or present itself is in risk mitigation and how much effort you put into something that you believe is going to create risk for you. And I think that creates an intellectual hurdle to people pushing more than one step.
So I think Juan perhaps believes in the greater goodness of people more so than I do. And I think that I agree that all of those things are impediments, but additionally, we have a governance challenge, and that which gets measured gets done, right? And historically, it has not been an incentive that has been put forward to foundations and endowments, because the governance structure is such that it was not a priority for a variety of reasons. Right. I think that the shift that has happened in recent years around the increased focus on DE&I, especially after the George Floyd incident and the sort of the light that got shown on the fact that there is none, has sort of shifted the dynamic slightly. And, you know, the story will be told 10 years from now. We will see what the uptake is like. But for sure, this concept of, you know, what is the role that you're playing in, you know, sort of creating barriers for people is now something that everybody's thinking about, right? And so boards who didn't traditionally or hadn't before ever had to think about them and whether or not it made them look bad or had an influence on them now has to think about whether or not they're playing a role. And they're increasingly saying to their CIOs, their CEOs, what are we doing? And you need to put incentives in place for people to look at these things or add these things. And now that that's the case, everybody is now turning to figure out what they can do. So at least there is action now. And I don't know that there was before a natural incentive. And again, it's like we all have our natural true norths that are based out of our experience. If you don't have a lot of CIOs and CEOs who have been underrepresented and realize that that is a problem that they were not seen at some point, and so therefore they have to reach back and see other people, then you don't have an incentive for them to do it until somebody says, I know this is not your experience, but you need to pay attention to this because it's a problem. And I think that's hopefully a shift that's happened. Everyone's now saying, you may not have noticed, but perhaps you should notice that there's a whole group of people who have not participated and we need engagement. So,
I was just going to add, if it's okay, on this one, I had two answers to it that I think are important. One is this term supplier diversity is something that has been talked about by anchor institutions forever. You know, whenever I talk to a university president and ask them about what are you doing to work with minority-owned companies, support minority entrepreneurship, they always talk about the construction contract that they gave at the university to a minority construction firm. And sometimes they'll talk about the janitorial services and the catering contracts and things like that that went to minority firms. They know that the wealth and jobs and power and influence in today's society often are in financial services, professional services, technology. But everyone's just been in the habit of going down this path of supplier diversity. And so what we have to do, I think, is what the University of Chicago has done. They've transformed that term and used the term business diversity. And now they work with over 100 minority-owned companies in every aspect of their spend, you know, from money management to legal to accounting to public relations to government affairs and technology, et cetera. And I think that's the model. So I think one of the things to actually, I always like concrete solutions is, you know, get rid of this term supplier diversity. It's literally 40 years out of date. And use the term business diversity to signal that your institutions are open to doing business in everything that you spend money on. And the second thing, of course, I know Kim and Juan know this very well, leadership matters. And, you know, I've mentioned the University of Chicago a couple of times, that President Bob Zimmer was willing and able and really pushed his vice presidents to work with minority companies in everything they do. And of course, Juan's boss, Alberto, has been extraordinary. You know, he's been one of the most dynamic CEO in the foundation world, pushing for diversity and inclusion and making it visceral, you know, and very vocalized it and inspiring the people who work at the Knight Foundation to do that. And leadership matters. And if you have a chairman of the board, you have a CEO who's committed to diversity and inclusion, doors will open. But too often that chairman or that CEO doesn't have that kind of progressiveness that an Alberto has or a Bob Zimmer. So those would be my two ideas.
Yeah, I just want to add, and I think both those comments are incredibly important, to echo or to amplify Kim's point of governance. In 2010, when we kind of first asked ourselves at Knight Foundation this question, Alberto, to John's point, asked me, like, well, what is diversity inside our portfolio? It was not something that we had examined, and we were kind of shocked at how little there was. We had one commitment to an African-American owned firm, $7.5 million out of a $2+ billion portfolio. And our direction to our CIO was, this is going to become a core element that you are going to be examining. You're going to be finding opportunities. And that's within the context of our spend rate and our targets for return. We aren't going to adjust those at all. And every quarter, we're going to report to the investment committee how we're doing and what the diversity percentages are. We don't have a target. We don't have a minimum. We don't have a maximum. We just report on it because it is something that we need to amplify. We want to amplify. And today, more than a third of the portfolio is managed by diverse-owned firms. So close to more than $1 billion is managed by diverse-owned firms. And I think part of that was, to Kim's point, we measure it. And that becomes something that we discuss at the governance level every quarter. And I speak with our CIO about it very frequently in between those meetings.
So, you know, I'm sorry, we're barely letting you get past this question, but I will tell you that one of the first things I did when I got to Columbia was require that we do a survey of our managers around diversity. And then we reported that back to the board, and they were like, oh, we need to do some work on this. It was almost like this gave them permission to say that this was an important feature that they wanted to pay attention to. So it's a combination. Everybody has to be committed to this as a concept for it to work.
That's fantastic. Juan and Kim, you should be very proud of these efforts, and all other CIOs and management teams and boards should be thinking about gathering the data so that they can react to it. Let's talk, this is the last question, but let's talk a little bit about the youth. Obviously, social issues these days are very much led by the energy of Gen Z, Gen Y. So Kim, you of course are at Columbia, it's a university. Campuses are often the hub where ideas around these issues take place. Students are often pressuring their institutions to make changes, taking names off of buildings, divesting from fossil fuels, right? And we did talk a little bit about how diverse zone managers find themselves lumped into the impact vertical or the ESG vertical. So why focus so much on the E? Where's that element from students? Why aren't students pushing their universities to invest with diverse owned businesses, you know, as they look at the endowment? Is it a knowledge gap? Do we have to wait till those students have done, you know, 1 or 2 years in business school to even understand that that's a factor? I don't know. It's a open-ended question. I'm speculating, but I think John and Kim will probably have a lot to say here. And Juan, of course, if there's anything else, feel free to add.
So I think that students are becoming increasingly loud about a lot of issues, and there are some that are raising this. But I think that the climate issue was actually a little easier for people to hold on to because it affects everybody in the same way. There's a little bit of asking people to be generous, to say, there's this group that's not participating, and that's important to me, even though I am participating, right? And so I think that increasingly we're of a generation that has had more interaction with lots of different type of people, and you know, they have access to media in ways that they didn't before, and so they are seeing the challenge. And at Columbia specifically, we're seeing a lot more of students coming in and saying, you know, what are we doing? Why don't we have exposure? But I always caution people, because as much as they are exciting and they bring lots of good information, they're also not exactly the client all the time, right? Because they don't always pay the bills and they are not the ones donating. So I think there's a lot of myth around how much students influence. They amplify an issue that the university is already thinking about, I think more often than not. And if a university believes that this issue will keep them or hurt their ability to recruit and retain talent, be it students or professors, for sure they will jump on it. And I think that's the rub, right? Like right now we're seeing it is increasingly challenging the business model. And so students are being heard on the issue a little bit more loudly than they had in the past.
That's fantastic. John, any closing thoughts, particularly as someone who's launched a program at University of Chicago around strengthening the pipeline and also the Ariel Community Academy, which of course teaches kids about investing early. What energy do we need to be seeing from students? What is the reason why there could be more?
It is an interesting question. I mean, back when I was in college, you know, all of us were marching around Nassau Hall, our main building at Princeton, around divestment from South Africa. It was a key issue that students were very energized around. None of us thought to ask the question of who's managing the endowment, the diversity of the team at Princeton's endowment office. We didn't question that. We didn't think about who was actually managing the dollars, who were the outside money managers. And I think partly it's because we hadn't been exposed to what an endowment office does and how money is being managed. We didn't have parents and grandparents teaching us about the stock market and teaching us about the magic of compound interest. So I think that lack of exposure, again, was the reason we weren't in there creating energy around the lack of economic opportunity within major endowments.
Thank you all. Juan Martinez of Knight Foundation, Kim Liu of Columbia University, and John Rogers of Ariel Investments.
Thanks so much for listening to our conversation series for Black History Month. And check us out every week this month or visit our website, ArielInvestments.com, ArielInvestments.com.